Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. This is the final stream of the first night, and this is with Oren McIntyre. Now, you might have heard it pronounced different ways, but apparently the correct way is Oren. So welcome, Oren, to Millennial. And would you like to introduce yourself to my audience? Because I know that there will be overlap, but some people might not know you. So welcome.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thank you so much for having me. I'm somebody who's been doing YouTube, and I guess Twitter is probably what I'm known for a little more now. It wasn't my intention, but I've been doing YouTube for about a year and a half.
I have to say, I do see your tweets being shared around on Gab and Telegram an awful lot. I screenshotted and shared around. So that's, you're obviously, that's. See, I'm not on YouTube anymore, and I'm not on Twitter anymore. So it's difficult to keep track of, you know, where people are and what they're good at. So my apologies for not realizing that. But, you know, Twitter is something that constantly evolves the landscape. So, you know.
Yeah, no problem. We could all be gone off there tomorrow. So that's there's no reason to, you know, it's nice to do well there, but don't expect your account to exist the next day. But yeah, mainly my focus was doing YouTube, and someone who used to work a little bit in politics, and then I was a reporter, and watching a lot of what was going on in the political landscape, 2015, 2016, especially, like a lot of people kind of saw, things weren't working the way that I had them described to me. They didn't make a lot of sense. You know, the way I had learned politics was supposed to work. And so I started reading stuff that was a little more off the beaten path, listening to some people who I hadn't heard of before. And that just kind of took me down the rabbit hole. And as I was reading all these different things, I was somebody who likes to describe, you know, kind of what I'm learning and that kind of thing. So started putting that on YouTube, and that's kind of how the channel got started.
So when was that? When did you start your channel?
Like I said, I think about a year and a half ago. I think we're about that point, yo. So it hasn't been very long. I'm relatively new. It's kind of interesting because I'm still catching up with a lot of the history. You know, there's so many people who've been around this for, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, some a decade. You know, in some of these cases, not YouTube, but, you know, in other places, you know, forums and such. And so I'm relatively new. I'm playing catch up with a lot of this stuff, but. Was doing my best to kind of look a lot of political theory and that kind of thing. And just, like I said, make videos as I went along, different things I was learning, that kind of thing. So,
yeah. I mean, it's a nice, like that first year and a half, I can remember my first sort of year, and it was very, it was really liberating, because at that point there isn't the weight of expectations from viewers. You're just sort of improvising and seeing what works and what doesn't. So it's a very nice time. The first few years is really nice. In my case, it and that's maybe to do with my own psychology, but I eventually felt sort of paralyzed by various things, including the censorship, which is something that you will face on YouTube. But nonetheless, you mentioned that the political system didn't work as you had believed it worked. So can you go into that? I mean, I don't know if this is the kind of thing you want to talk about. But,
oh, no, that's fine.
It's an interesting statement. So if you could clarify.
Sure. I mean, I got my degree in politics. I worked in kind of American Republican Party politics a little bit. And like I said, I was a reporter. And it was just a situation where, you know, you'd been taught that, you know, you go out, you get support from constituents, you know, obviously you've got the influence of big lobbies and that kind of thing. But for the most part, you know, just the general representation in government that you'd expect. It's what you get taught in like a civics class or an American government class or, you know, whatever. And that was the way I'd approached it. And especially as I was reporting, I wasn't working for a big outlet. I was working for something small and regional, but just watching the sausage get made, being in, you know, kind of these press gaggles and watching kind of the news get shaped in real time, was a little bit eye opening. And then on top of that, you know, just obviously the Trump election, the first one, and everything that went into that, and how wrong the polls were, how wrong the reporting had been, how much it seemed like the press was willing to lie about the issues that mattered to people and what was now, pushing the environment.
Yeah. Now, sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
The thing about the media lying to about different issues, about stories, when did you first notice that? Because I think for a lot of people, the first time was the Trayvon Martin case. I think a huge one was the Trump election, Hillary Clinton. The dishonesty was just astonishing then. And then, of course, subsequent things, COVID, and then the 2020 election, and, of course, the George Floyd thing. But what would you say? I mean, what's your relationship with the mainstream media and trusting it?
Well, like I said, it was interesting to actually be in the room when a lot of these things happened, because I started noticing that the questions that people had would often have nothing to do with the actual event they were at or, you know, what the person was talking about. And I think really a lot of it was watching the immigration issue. It seemed so clear, you know, and obviously that this can be, it impacts Europe and America differently. But in America, it's so clear that mass immigration is not popular. It's not popular with Democrats or Republicans. No one really seems to want this except for a very specific portion of activist voters. But it never changes. The Republicans seem to think it's essential. Obviously, the Democrats think it's essential. And no matter what their base says, no matter what the polls say, nothing ever actually changes. Their positions always are pro-open borders in one way or another. Even the people who are supposed to be against it don't actually take any kind of action. And just watching, you know, issues consistently like that, you know, immigration is just one example, but there are so many where both parties were willing to take things that were wildly unpopular and push that agenda. And then again, that's just not the way that representative democracy is supposed to work. And if that's not what's happening, then what is actually happening? And that's what, again, led me to start reading different thinkers, different political theory, looking for, okay, if the popular representation in democracy is not actually what's driving the system, what is driving the system? And, you know, that's where I started searching.
Yeah. And I'm guessing you would say it's an oligarchy.
Yes.
I know that you have a video on your channel called How the U.S. Became an Oligarchy. So this would seem to marry up with my previous stream to some extent, which was with Mark Malone. And we were talking about, let's go into the concept of oligarchy, because a lot of people have heard the word, but they might not know exactly what it means. So how would you define that?
Well, a lot of people hear oligarchy and they think that, you know, means just a bunch of people with money run your country. And it certainly can. But oligarchy just means rule by the few. I think that's literally like the Greek translation. And so it just means that a small group of people, usually a particular class, but it could be anything, are what's running your country. In the case of America, again, a lot of people assume that it's entirely money driven. And of course, that's a massive part of it. But I would say, and I won't be the first to say this, I would say it's far closer to a theocratic oligarchy, where we have a small priestly class running kind of the ideology that really dictates the, you know, political thought and in many ways the values that are pushed through kind of our consensus-making apparatus, our media, our intelligentsia, our education system, everything. And so because we have a system that's like this, obviously, in a democracy, you need the people in order to rule. And at least theoretically, of course, you know, America is a democracy. And so the key, if you need to get people to vote a certain way, is to control their access to information, control what people think. And again, none of this is revolutionary. You can go back and read Noam Chomsky and all kinds of people who are saying similar things. But they are always saying it from the left. They're saying it from a position of they think that, you know, things are radically left enough and they're being controlled. But so, obviously we would come from a different direction.
Of course. And I guess from their perspective, I mean, I think Chomsky would have been writing from the 60s onwards, but I actually don't know. I know that he's like in his 90s now, but assuming this is the 60s, 70s, 80s, their notion was that the media, large corporations were run by conservatives, which is right wingers economically and culturally. I'm not sure that that was true even in the 60s. I don't know. I mean, what do you think about? What would you say about that? Like, was their bogeyman a fictitious one, even when they were writing about it, or not?
Well, I think that at that time, the seeds of what they would call the countercultural movement, but now has just become what is the mainstream culture, was there, and that's what they thought was being held back. I think the truth is, the majority of our country at that time and up to this point today increasingly is under the sway of a managerial class, right? It's not necessarily that the managerial class was fighting against their values at the time. And I think at this point, the managerial class has all but adopted their values. I think the managerial class was using what was most effective at the time to control people and get people where they wanted them to be. At the time of, you know, in the 60s and 70s, that, you know, the counterculture was so far outside the norm that I don't think it was useful for the vast majority, but it was a very valuable wedge that they were able to later use and now has obviously come to dominate our culture.
Well, absolutely. I tend to think of the example of, you know, Martin Luther King as the cuddly side of. He was the safe alternative, and the safe option, the mainstream option, the option that was palatable to the mainstream. And then there were more extreme radicals, lefty Marxist anarchists, and black activists who were not palatable to the mainstream. But it's their ideas, because he was accepted and his ideas assimilated into the mainstream. I say his ideas, you know what I mean. then, because that happened, it's now the radicals whose ideas are adopted and even mandated in the mainstream. So it's obviously a slippery slope thing.
Yeah, one of the keys, especially again in a system like democracy, is wherever there's division, wherever there's disagreement, there's an opportunity to rule. And so what you're constantly trying to do is outflank people, and the only way in our culture to outflank people, especially among the elites, that's acceptable is to move to the left. And so there's always a race for more power, and power always rests to the left because that's the only acceptable direction for politics to move. And so at the time, of course, like you're saying, you know, King was the more presentable face, but as more and more people want to take more and more power, the only place for them to outflank their opponents in their class is to move further and further to the left. And the only thing they can do is adopt more and more radical positions in order to obtain that power and push their rivals further down the ladder.
So I suppose the question would be, to what extent, I mean, we can understand the left and the right as labels that were definitely still relevant in the 60s, 70s, 80s. But I think probably from the 90s onwards, those labels are less and less applicable. Now, we do still have a far left, for sure, the Antifa. But I'm not even sure that they represent what they think they represent. I mean, they side with big business constantly. They oppress the little man gleefully. They laugh at people being subjected to poverty because of their ideas. They mock the dispossessed, the marginalized, the disenfranchised. So they call themselves far left, but I'm not sure in what ways they are. And they certainly, I don't believe that they have much solidarity with the working class. I think that has just completely fallen away. That pretension, or well, perhaps that attitude on the left. I'm sure at one point it was genuine for a lot of them. But then on the right, well, I guess the right, the mainstream right, have remained pretty consistent in that they believe in economic freedom. That's about it, really. Right. I don't really know what else you could say. But obviously, a consensus has now been reached where, yes, well, this might now be obsoleted by COVID and the Great Reset and all of this. But certainly, in the 2000s, the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, there was a consensus where you could have economic freedom and you could, you know, we're not going to shame anyone for being rich or becoming rich. So you can have that, but you've also got to have the left-wing ideas, the cultural ideas of the far left. So that's the consensus that, I guess, neoliberal, I don't know what label you would call that. But now we seem to be moving into a wholly new era. And I guess we can get onto that later. But at this point, like, if we survey the 2010s, for that era, do you think that the terms left and right were still valid in any real way, or in what ways?
I think that the confusion we have is that, especially in the Western tradition, we took two halves of liberalism and we just kind of cracked them and spread them over our political spectrum. And so I don't think we really have a right wing. I think we have a progressive left and a classical left. We have a progressive left and we have a classical liberals, they like to call themselves now, right? And so what we really had was just this tension between old liberalism and progressive liberalism. I don't think we've had really a right wing. And that's why you see so much confusion as, oh, how could the left be, you know, siding with big business? How could they be supporting, you know, these rich mega donors, be supported by these rich mega donors? Well, I don't think it's very hard. I think the point is, the best explanation I think I've heard of the left and right divide is hierarchies. Whether you agree that natural hierarchies are good and to be followed and valuable and should be woven into the fabric of society, or whether they should be subverted. And so the left is less about helping the weak or the working class, so much as they are for using those people at the moment to subvert the natural hierarchy, because that allows them to again generate power. The power was in deconstructing classical ideas of the way society should be, classic hierarchies, and empowering people who otherwise would not be in power. And when you do that, you're making them subservient to you. They own you. You own them. They wouldn't have power without you. And so what they're doing is building a coalition of the weak. And at, you know, early on, that might have been the working class, that might have been the, you know, poor, that might have been women or whatever. But as they continue to move, as they continue to subvert those hierarchies, they need to move to ever more extremes in order to find people who would benefit from their coalition and be entirely enthralled to it. And so I think that's why there's so much confusion as to what left and right really meant, because we took the definition that was handed to us. Well, the right is about big business and cutting taxes and whatever, right? But that's not what right wing is. That's never what right wing was. And left wing surely was not about just helping the everyman. It was about seeking power. And if at the moment the rhetoric about helping the working man was good for them, then that's what they subscribed to.
I mean, I think it's important to differentiate between different parts of the left. You've got the pragmatists, the activists, the leaders, and then you've got the actual true believers, you know, the useful idiots, the well intentioned people who really do want to help the needy and the marginalized. I mean, obviously they're going to have different motivations, these groups, and some of them are going to be just arch pragmatists using pre-existing schisms and fault lines in order to accrue power. And then there are the ones who just get dragged along with that and tell themselves, no, this is for the greater good, this is for the better of, you know. But I guess then we can move into this era. And it seems to me that now, I mean, we still use the term the left, and I think that's probably going to persist even for those of us who think it's an outmoded term. We still use it to refer to increasingly unsuitable things like, the global elite, the global high finance. We're using the term the left to describe the forces that impose LGBT onto kids at schools, and big business, which imposes the values of diversity onto the public. I mean, calling that the left is kind of ridiculous. And yes, it does seem to be where we are. And people, I think the term is going to persist because it's just there. But at this point, it's not a coalition of the weak. It's very much a coalition of the strong at this point. That's what I was going to get to. That I think certainly once upon a time, the left was a coalition of the weak. It was the marginalized, the whatever, the minorities and all this. But at this point, that just doesn't... I mean, I can imagine that Antifa still believe that they still have that conception of themselves. But they are just the lack... They're the useful idiots. At this point, the left is not a coalition of the weak. It's a coalition of the most powerful entities in the... Well, certainly in the Western world. You know, big tech, the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, the UN, the EU. So it's... You see what I mean? It's not really the left anymore in any real sense.
Sure, but that's always true, right? Like, there's always the eternal revolution is essential, right? We see this in so many ways, right? That, you know, when communist parties come to power, it's still the revolutionary party, right? And this is the case with the left. Like, yes, they control everything. They control almost every institution. They have an iron grip on culture, like finance, absolutely. But they still portray themselves as just one loss away from, you know, civilizational collapse, the return to, you know, women being shackled to their kitchens and slavery returning. Yeah, we're only one election away. And forget even the election at this point. In America, we're getting a story or two every other day from the press about how, you know, Donald Trump's going to rush in and initiate a coup at any moment and democracy is over, right? And so even when they have almost complete and total control, this narrative is still in the forefront. It's so central to their identity that even when they have absolutely crushing totalitarian power, more power than they've ever had, especially in a place like America, they're still the desperate victims who are one Supreme Court justice away from The Handmaid's Tale, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's incredible how they managed to maintain this self-image of the underdog, and how everything is... I mean, yeah, we've made progress. We've made great progress, but there's still so far left to go. Well, no pun intended. There's just so much left to still to achieve. And I saw a tweet the other day shared around. It was about how it was a judgment, one of these recent trials in America, and the comment was it's so unusual for justice to prevail, and it was like a black murderer had got off or something like that, and it's like how can they tell themselves that? How can they tell themselves that white supremacy is reigning supreme in America today? That is incredible. And I think this does get to this point that about we're now at this stage where we cannot coexist with these people. I mean, people, you know, individuals are saying that. I'm not going to state that as some kind of fact. I'm just saying people are saying that now, that we've reached a stage where it's just impossible, because we live in entirely different worlds. We have entirely different conceptions of things. I mean, and now, of course, COVID has become another fault line here. But I think a lot of the left genuinely believe that, for example, Donald Trump was a fascist, and he wanted to be Hitler. He wanted to round people up. He was a crazed racist. I mean, there is no, and of course they'll cite things like he wanted to build a wall, but then so did Hillary Clinton 10 years earlier, and I think Barack Obama even talked about it at the start of his presidency. So it's quite remarkable how this keeps going on. And I've forgotten where I was going with this. Would you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we look at the pace of change, and you look at Barack Obama's position on same-sex marriage in 2008 was that marriage was between a man and a woman. less than 15 or, you know, what, like 16, 17 years later, whatever, we are at the point where that position will get you fired from working at a McDonald's, right? Like you can't hold a basic working, you know, a basic average, you know, minimum wage job with that position and say it out loud at this point. And so if you want to know, you know, the pace that we are running is extreme. But again, I think that this is largely part of, again, this power struggle. I think that the idea that, you know, fascism is just around the corner and the, you know, the collapse of democracy will happen the moment that, you know, there's one Supreme Court ruling in favor of the right. This is part of their founding myth, right? This is the founding myth of the new civic religion. There's this great book by Christopher Caldwell, a very normal mainstream American conservative, who wrote this book that I can't believe got published, honestly, about kind of the civil rights regime and how basically the good intentions of, you know, kind of people in the 50s and 60s and how the idea of civil rights was sold to middle America was used to basically create a bypass legally for protected classes. And because this incentive was set up to basically let anyone who is defined as a protected class completely circumvent the Constitution and work through this civil rights legislation, this kind of web of civil rights rulings and legislations and such, it basically incentivized everyone to identify in one way, shape, or form as a protected class. And so we just see this rush continuously to find more and more marginalized groups that, again, can be used to circumvent the law. Everything is an emergency. You know, we have to take emergency steps because at any point we could just have it all collapse and, you know, go back to, you know, pre-Civil War America. And this is absolutely essential. It's an essential myth for them to keep pushing because it's literally the basis for their power. It's for many people, this is what America is now. This is American history, to the point where we have, you know, the New York Times trying to go back and literally rewrite American history with things like this, the 1619 Project, so that they can fit everything into this myth. American history actually started in 1619 and then, you know, teleported into 1965, yeah, with nothing in between.
And it's the same in Britain. You know, in Britain, there's a coin, a 50 pence, like 50p coin was unveiled about, I don't know, 6 months ago, that says Diversity Built Britain. That's a special edition coin, and there were loads of them in circulation now. So Diversity Built Britain. But diversity only started in, like, 1950. So, I mean, there wasn't a Britain prior to 1950. Yeah, that's the message implicit in that coin. There's nothing. There's no other interpretation possible, really. Britain just didn't really exist. It was just a wasteland.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, all I can say is I'm sorry, because this poison seeped right out of American media and universities and all across the Western world. This is why you see Black Lives Matter protests in Ireland, right? You see Black Lives Matter protests in places where there is no historical context, where there isn't even a population to be offended or oppressed. Yeah. But it doesn't matter, because every one of the elites that is being educated in American universities, is being soaked in American cultures, knows that this dogma is the functional religion of their caste. And it's also the main way they outflank each other. The main way to advance yourself is to be more woke than the person to your left. You have to outflank them. And so there's just this constant incentive inside America, and unfortunately throughout most of the places that America influences, to take up this banner, even when there is no historical connection in your homeland, no grievance to actually be levied. It doesn't matter. This is still the way that class of managerial elite is taught to behave. It's the way they are educated. It's the values that are inculcated in them. And that's what they carry with them no matter where they go.
Yeah, and the BLM thing obviously took a step up in last year, in the middle of last year, with the George Floyd death, and that was I mean, it was just unbelievable. Then you had BLM demos in London, but you also had them in like Stockholm and Germany and the Netherlands. It was really quite something. I mean, I could understand at least a cultural connection, you know, within the Anglosphere between America and Britain. So it'd still be ridiculous to have BLM stuff going on here. But when you're talking about Sweden and, you know, these other countries, it's just preposterous. But of course, this is more to do with the global culture. At this point, I think that it's, you know, the West is culturally one large single thing to a great extent at this point, where it wasn't even 20 years ago. Now, I've mentioned recently on my own show that I went to Amsterdam in 2001. And it felt quite foreign. You know, I mean, I was about 20, 18 or something. And I was young and I was there and it felt different. If you go, and I went back a couple of years ago just before COVID, and now it just feels like a global city. So this, it's absorbed all of this. And so I think, and you know, this, I'm certainly not having a go at you or at America. I don't enjoy saying this, but I think that the age of America being the sort of center of the modern world and modern life is kind of over now. I think we're moving into a more amorphous state of things where there is just global culture, and what it means, I guess, is limited to the West to a great extent, but. But still, it's. I don't think America is as influential, is as central to all of this as it used to be. As I say, I'm not anti-America. I don't enjoy saying that. I just think it's the reality of things. Something you said earlier was that the left has historically used it's created a sense of emergency in order to justify doing things, especially with regard to minority groups. But in the last 2 years, a new emergency has arisen that eclipses all minority groups, which is COVID. And I think a really telling example of this is that in Australia, they are rounding up Aborigines who refuse to get vaccinated and putting them into quarantine camps, isolation camps. Now, 2 years ago, this would have been completely unimaginable, unbelievable, because just on an optics level, it's really an egregious violation of modern of you know, progressive ideas. The idea that you could arrest and quarantine people of a minority group and large numbers of them, and then not hate yourself for doing this. Not castigate yourself for doing this, not find out the people responsible for making this decision and get them fired. It's just incredible. Because, of course, Australia has this history with the Aborigines and you know, their oppression and so on. But COVID eclipses the Aborigine thing. It eclipses their status as an oppressed minority. And I think it's going to be the same elsewhere as well. I think it will be the same in Canada and America if the COVID program goes as far in those countries as it's gone in Australia. Then I think you'll probably see the same thing, the equivalents happening, where race is just ignored and people are quarantined, isolated, arrested, fined, and possibly imprisoned, even when it's clearly when there are clear racial trends involved in it. And I think that because this is the point, that we now seem to be moving beyond even this. I mean, obviously BLM is still going to persist because it's useful to the powers that be. It's a good way to deconstruct the white majority in the Western countries. It's still going to go on. But I think there's also this new paradigm of COVID and climate change, which is going to take precedence over it. So you'll have that race just does not matter anymore, or at least it's not a, it's not the number one, it's not the top of the victim hierarchy. I think the victim hierarchy, I guess you could say the top of that is going to be, you know, the planet Earth, or the human species as a totality. The vaccinated, the good portion of the human species. I don't know. That's just some random thoughts. But would you have any responses to that?
Well, I think in America, it's always going the or I shouldn't say always, but for there's still some rubber left on that tire for them when it comes to using racial issues as a wedge. So I think they'll continue to use it, but what they'll use it for is what we saw with, again, the George Floyd riots, the BLM riots, where it's lockdowns for everyone except those who are on the holy mission of marching in the name of George Floyd, right? And so you'll probably see the requirement for compliance apply to people of all races, but there'll be special dispensations given for those who are serving the regime in the proper way. And also for there'll be selective enforcement on certain communities. You're probably far less likely to see it enforced on some communities than others. Now, that said, I think that you're right that the Australian model shows us how quickly the left can discard racial narratives when they need to, right? And that's why I say it's kind of useful to understand that it was always about power and not necessarily about the underdog or the working class or racial minorities or any of these things. And so I think what you're seeing now in the West is basically a totalitarian arms race. There's this guy, Bertrand Juvenal, and he said that basically states are always in a totalitarian arms race because power naturally wants to centralize. And so as soon as like France gets the levee en masse, you got to figure out a way to conscript your population, because if you don't, France is just going to roll you, right? And so anytime a neighboring country achieves a certain level of control over their population, other countries that want to compete basically have to get on that level or fall behind. And so when we're talking about globalization, we see more interaction and these governments, these elites are more likely to work together. It's less combative than it might have been in history beforehand. But I think you're still in a situation where these governments see an obvious way they can accelerate their control over their populations. And again, maybe even due to our connectivity, they're able to justify those, taking those rights in reducing the protections that maybe minorities and other classes would have had against these things, because it becomes even more essential to push, like you said, the vaccinations, the quarantines. It's for their own good at the end of the day, right? It's, you know, that you're not hurting them, you're helping them. They just couldn't get it. They just couldn't get the vaccines. They couldn't isolate. So it's all in their interest anyway. It's not actually, they're not real prison camps. Even people on the Australian, you know, center and center right are saying, oh, don't be ridiculous. These are basically resorts, right? Like they're showing women in bikinis on Instagram. So basically these things are, they're just voluntary. They're just, you know, it's just a nice place for people to sit out their summer and enjoy, you know, getting a tan. That's all they are.
I mean, the thing is, I'm sure it's not slave labor. I'm sure it is quite leisurely, but it's still, you can't leave. I mean, it's you'll get arrested, you'll get chased down, hunted, and brought back if you try to leave. I mean, it is clearly incarceration or containment. I don't know what if a different word would be more palatable, but it is a reduction, a clear reduction in your liberty, even if you're not being, you know, working in a salt mine or something like that. It still is that thing. But I don't know, this I think you're right that they will, and somebody commented this, that they'll just do whatever works. If you know, if this month they need BLM pushed, then they'll allow BLM marches to breach COVID rules. But if this month they need a rise in vaccinations, then they will, then I can imagine them saying no BLM this month because that would violate COVID regulations and so on, and this minority group that has been historically oppressed and that we've been going on about being historically oppressed for decades, well, they're not getting the vaccine. So clearly they need better education and they need a helping hand into the back of the van so that they can get vaccinated. That sort of thing, I think, because and this is to do with the, you know, the full spectrum dominance of the airwaves that they now have, thanks to the castration of social media, they can just get away with whatever. It doesn't really matter. They don't need, because the people who would have asked questions are no longer employed in the media. It's all of one mind now. And I think this is what really, one of the things that really emerged with COVID, that there is no opposition, certainly not within polite society anymore. Whereas, you know, again, even in the 90s, there was, and even in the 2000s, there was, you know, there were news interviewers who would disagree with the prime minister, with the president, with the health secretary or whatever. Whereas now everything that they say is just taken as gospel.
Well,
quite remarkable.
I think you're right that their ability to manipulate media has gotten to the point where they feel like they can get away with anything. But that's as much a problem for them as a solution, because it provides to them a temptation which is dangerous. In a traditional situation where you need to manufacture a consent, you need human networks, right? Like, you need to have a consistent message that works itself through many different institutions. You have to take time laying the groundwork, building the ideology, you know, in order to bring about the level of control we're talking about. Now they just have this constant fire hose of propaganda that they can fire at pretty much anyone, and they can change what the story is at any given moment to, like you're saying, whatever works. But the problem is that at some point that probably has diminishing returns, right? I think of people who used to say, you know, well, once, you know, we have certain kinds of bombs or something, then that's the end of traditional warfare, right? Because, like, you can just, you know, people will just carpet bomb a place from the sky and that'll be the end of every war. But then you look at something like Afghanistan and you see that actually the most advanced military in the world can lose to a bunch of guys with Stone Age technology in a lot of ways, because they don't have the traditional necessary, you know, ground game to get it done. And I think that the regime kind of threatens itself with its liberal use of kind of this propaganda, constantly switching stories, you going to whatever works for power at any given time. It's lazy, and it while they feel like they can get away with anything right now, I feel like eventually this has diminishing returns. Eventually people start seeing through the cracks. But obviously at the moment they're getting, you know, a lot of efficiency out of it. So they're continuing to do it. They're continuing to just hit us with BLM, you know, 1 week and the end of democracy the next week and COVID the next week. And like you said, climate change. At the end of the day, they're looking for that formula that gives them endless power, right? Where they can always just draw on this issue. They thought it was going to be race, and they tried to set up climate change for a long time and it never quite stuck, but COVID seemed like the golden moment, right? But even now it seems like that might wane, and so they're kind of trying to switch climate change into that spot, but you just don't know where they're going to land, and that's a problem for them in the long run.
Well, I mean, yeah, I can see what you mean. My previous guest said that, in his opinion, this is all quite pre-planned, and the COVID thing was just an emergency. I mean, what do you, I guess we, he said that it was an emergency sort of tool in order to accelerate things. What would you, I mean, we should probably talk about your general views about COVID, about the last 2 years, because this is the first time you've appeared on Millennial. It tends to be, certainly for this year and last year, it's been a central issue, the central issue. So in general terms, how would you characterize COVID, COVID-19, the Great Reset, the lockdowns, the vaccine, and so on?
Well, I think one of the great things that the left benefits from, or, you know, whatever you want to call them, the global elite, I think one of the great things they benefit from is that stranglehold on propaganda. Because if we look back at the beginning of COVID, they didn't take it seriously, right? This was their storyline was, this is not going to be a big deal. You can see Fauci talking about how nobody needs to worry about this. You had Nancy Pelosi saying, you know, if you're worried about COVID, you're racist. This is anti-Asian propaganda. You need to go out. Like, she literally went out with San Francisco politicians and said, you have to go to Chinatown and hug a Chinese person to show that you're not worried about COVID. Like, this is a real thing they did. And we've just disappeared this. This is all down the memory hole. But at the beginning of this thing, the left was dismissing this and even using their standard, like, oh, it's racist to care about this disease. But as the death toll started to tick up, and as this started to look like it might have some legs, we started to see a shift in their position. And because they control the media and they control all the consensus-making apparatus, they get to dictate the story and they get to dictate the positions that the opposition picks up. And so once they decided that they needed to shift positions, they just started painting any kind of concern about COVID as their position, and opposition to any kind of mitigation was right wing conspiracy mongering, right? Like, this, it was Alex Jones stuff or whatever, right? And so they did this switch where they completely 180'd their position over the course of a month or so, as the numbers looked like they were going to change. And COVID's a real disease. Like, people die from it. It's not crazy that you needed to take some steps against it. But obviously they saw, once they could manufacture this, a huge advantage, because they could turn this thing into a situation for control. It became what they always wanted something like climate change to be, something that was always going to be with us, could always justify more lockdowns, passports, you know, tracking, all this stuff could be justified through this, all this stuff that they wanted for a long time. And they could also use this at the same time to leverage it against their enemies and paint them as crazy anti-science, you know, conspiracy wackos. And so, again, because they control the narrative, they're able to make this change in real time and avoid what could have been a disaster narrative-wise for them, while also backing the entire right wing into this position of, like, oh, it's no big deal.
Yeah, it's really worked out well for them. It's been a fantastic strategy. I think that my own perception of this is that the national governments were still in charge for the first few months. And then over the course of March, the Bill Gates and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the World Economic Forum, these sorts of bodies sent their people to the national government and persuaded them, or simply decreed, I don't know, here's what you're going to do. Here's a better approach. Here's what you should do. You've got to take this seriously. And even when the numbers start to go down again and it's clear that it isn't a terrible killer, you're still going to scaremonger your public, your citizens, your voters, and because this is a program this is the program we want. I think that I remember it. I think Nancy Pelosi. I remember in Britain that they were saying, "Well, just go for herd immunity." That was Boris Johnson's original thing. I remember in Italy they were saying that they had a thing about hug a Chinese person, and then there were lots of deaths. But again, those deaths, it's not clear why. Because they were shoving people into care homes, into a confined space together, and then there's the medicines. Who knows whether that was engineered or not? I'm not saying it was. I'm just saying I wouldn't. At this point, nothing would surprise me at all. So they very quickly, I think that it seems likely to me that what happened was the national governments were just bumbling along, doing their thing as usual in February 2020. But by the end of March, or by April, May 2020, the much more overtly globalist organizations had taken control of it. And that's why you see this change from the sort of 2010s attitude of, oh, it's racist to be against, to think that this is a serious virus, to this is a very serious virus and we shoot a very serious disease, and it now eclipses everything, to the point where we'll even, you know, quarantine minority groups and so on, in order to control it. I mean, that seems to have been the change that, I don't know, I mean, I'm not saying this is definitely the case, it just seems like a profound change happened in the first half of 2020, the governments.
No, yeah, and I think what it is we have a decentralized global governance, and so what you have is lag time, right? Like, you had a point at which, you know, I don't think this stuff is completely centrally planned, and so you have a moment where the left isn't sure what to do, or again, you know, global elites, whatever, they're not sure what to do, they're not sure what the plan is going to be, how are we going to run this. But once you start seeing the narrative take shape, that's when you see the NGOs, you know, media organizations, everybody starts stepping in, okay, this is what we're going to do. But you'll notice that even through all of that, the American border stayed wide open, right? So Australia might be putting people in, you know, Aborigines in camps, but in America, we're not even pumping the brakes on illegal immigration. And so you can see what the actual goal is in here, right? And I'm sure at some level, some of these people believe this, right? The mid-tier managers probably are on board with this. But at the end of the day, the goal never changes, even if the mechanism changes. We're always pushing the same direction.
Yeah, yeah. A good example of this contradiction was in Germany, where the borders were effectively closed. They weren't accepting any people coming over except for refugees. And refugees were entirely immune. This was I don't know when this was, it was a period in the middle of 2020 where refugees were entirely immune from border controls. They could still flow into Germany in whatever numbers, but no one else. And that's quite incredible, really. Because obviously, refugees, you've got no idea where they've come from, what medical treatment they've had, what experiences they've had along the way of their travels. They're the last people you would let in during a pandemic. And yet they're the only ones that Germany did let in.
So I can give you a good chuckle here. You might not be familiar with this because it's America-centric. But during in the last few months, obviously, we had that situation where the COVID lockdowns and Donald Trump had, you know, said there was going to be this check coming, and then Joe Biden won and he said this check was going to come. This relief check is, you know, $1,500 or whatever to bail people out, you know, help them pay rent or whatever. And then he never did. He never sent the money out. The check never came. But a couple months ago, the Biden administration announced that they were planning to pay immigrant families who had been separated from each other at the border a $50,000 per family settlement. So American citizens could not receive a $1,500 check, but families who had entered America illegally could be paid $50,000.
Yeah, this is just astounding. And it's stuff like this that makes you realize our national governments simply don't work for us anymore. It's gone way beyond that. It's gone far beyond that at this point. There's no longer even that pretense about they work for you. And again, this is another thing that's changed over the last few years. The idea that politicians are our public servants and that they work for us, that's just gone. It's completely gone. So, same thing with the corporations. The idea that the customer is always right. You know, that was a given. That was a thing that people used to say. They don't say it anymore. You know, that we now have a very different relationship with corporate entities and with government. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, it's to the point now where we even see, I love these stories now about different TV shows and comedy specials and stuff, video games. Oh, well, this wasn't supposed to be good. You weren't supposed to like it. This was supposed to teach you a lesson, right? And so even our entertainment isn't for our entertainment. It's from our betters to let us know what we should be thinking or enjoying right now. And we see this constantly. And yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of this is because our elites no longer need to pretend to serve the people because the people are fungible, right? You can, if the people you have right now aren't voting for you, you can swap the population out for someone who will. And of course, democracy is the highest value. In New York, they just tried to, I don't remember if this passed, but they were trying to make it so non-citizens could vote in their elections. Like, you don't even have to do the fraud anymore. Like, we are just going to make it legal for people who are in no way a part of the society in a legal manner for them to vote openly in the elections and influence and decide who. And of course, the purpose of that is to make sure that you can, you know, at will change the nature of your electorate in order to produce the outcome you want. And so, yeah, why would you need to serve the needs of a native population or anyone who's even, you know, any polity living inside your borders at any moment? You can change that as necessary.
Yeah, this is the cliche of the government electing its own electorate, electing an alternative electorate who will do what it wants. It's quite funny and farcical and surreal, but that is what's been happening over the last few decades, or at least it's part of it. And I think you're right that this relationship, and it's part of the way things are going, where people are no longer tied to any land. That's an idea of the past that clearly the powers that be want to consign to the past. They want everyone now to be, as you said, fungible, where it just, they're, I don't know, you get those voters, you shunt them into that landmass where that particular region where they're required, because we need people to vote for the policies that we want in that area. So we'll just transport loads of people into there who are likely to vote for those policies. That's amazing. It's this using of democracy in reverse, almost. It's getting the results you want by having the people that you need to get the results you want.
Well, and that's that in that video you were talking about how the America became an oligarchy. This was Mosca's point, right? Is he said that the reason that, you know, democracy had failed in America, the reason that it had become an oligarchy, was that the branches of government didn't actually represent different interests in society. As the expansion of democratic power swept through the nation, as more and more people were enfranchised, and as an increasing share of the government was elected, the only thing that mattered was the ability to manipulate the electorate. It didn't matter what part of or branch of government you were in. Your power all came from the same place, which is manufacturing of consent through the democratic process. And his argument is that this is why you need aristocrats that are tied to specific bases of power. You need things that exist outside just the democratic mass. It's because, you know, the whole idea was democracy would give power to the people, but it did the exact opposite. It incentivized elites to find different people to give them power. And so what we see is that the more this myth of democracy has persisted, the more they can justify basically swapping the democratic polity out for whoever they need at the moment, because there are no ties to populations. There are no ties to different power bases. All the power comes from the same place, and it's the ability to manipulate those who would in theory be casting votes.
It's really amazing, isn't it, how much democracy has failed, because it's still talked about as, well, a reality, the reality of the way our societies function, and as the only way that they can really function. At least up till now. I mean, maybe we're at the cusp of a change here, and they'll start to be more open about technocracy and, you know, people like Klaus Schwab. Again, one of the things about Klaus Schwab and, you know, George Soros, Bill Gates, is that nobody elected them. And yet I don't see anyone complaining about that. I don't see anyone saying, well, who gave him power? Who gave him authority to tell the rest of us how we need to live? No one's bothering with that sort of token resistance anymore. And I think this might be a sort of instinctual recognition that democracy doesn't work. It's just on the part of the public. And so that they want leaders, they want people like Klaus Schwab to tell them what needs to be done and what should be done and what will be done. Or it could just be that, you know, the general public are now accustomed to democracy being a sham. I'm not sure.
Well, I think they've also lost any way to argue with those that control the institutions that manufacture science, right? The, in many ways, the reasons that these technocrats seem so unassailable is that science is the only justification, right? We need to be able to put everything on a spreadsheet. We need to be able to break everything down into numbers. Everything is about producing the best outcome in an actuarial table or whatever. And so, at, you know, when people want to oppose this stuff, they don't even have the language with which to do so, because everyone who controls the acceptable language for justifying points works inside this technocratic system, right? They're the ones who define what is acceptable when it comes to public health policy. They're the ones who define what democracy is, right? And they're the ones who are manufacturing all of the justification when it comes through kind of our reasoning apparatus. And so I don't think, because we don't have anything to compete with the technocratic justifications for actions, when you see someone like Klaus Schwab or Bill Gates take control, what really do you have to argue against these things? For on what authority would you oppose them? They're the smartest people. They're the people with all the scientists, all the experts. Experts say, right? And who are you to argue with the priests? I mean, the experts, right? Like, how can you possibly have something outside of their scientific reasoning that could oppose what they're pushing down upon you?
Yeah. And the sort of justification for that is science, is that, that they are rational, that they are reason-based, data-driven, and so on. But I think also implicit in it is this recognition that most people don't actually like democracy is inherently ridiculous. I mean, it's ridiculous that someone who's just basically stupid, his vote is given the equal weight as that of someone who's very intelligent, very sensible, very well read, very well informed, that these two things are treated equally. That is ridiculous, and I think that most people would agree regretfully, they would agree with that. I think that there is this, as you say, there's a sort of desire for, and I think that the desire, the need for hierarchy is just innate in people. And I think that democracy has always been a sort of indulgence. It's like letting the kids have more sweets than they really should have, and flattering them, you know, using democracy as a way to flatter them and thus get their acquiescence. But sometimes it doesn't go as planned, like with the Trump election in 2016 and with Brexit. And just in general, the mechanisms of a democratic government tend to be quite slow and lumbering and complicated. So I think it's... But both for, you know, for honest reasons and dishonest reasons, I can see why the elite would want to supplant democracy. A, because the public will not always vote for what they want, for what the elites want, and B, because democracy is, in any case, a slow process. Much faster if you can just tell a government what to do. If you can just, if a technocratic entity can just decree, just, you know, transmit orders down. And I think that's basically what seems to be on the way here. Would you say anything about that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree that that's certainly the direction they're moving. I think democracy was always about manufacturing outcomes through elite processes. But I think you're right that they're taking the tightest reins they have ever taken over that process. And we're getting stories again in America just last week or two. We started seeing stories about how opposition to Joe Biden is a threat to democracy. I kid you not. Like, I'm not making, you know, like, this is not me like restating the headline to make it more ridiculous. Literally, like, we have major media outlets releasing, like, well, if you oppose Joe Biden, then you are supporting Donald Trump. And they're writing these about their own people. They're writing these about media outlets that are printing something bad about Joe Biden. So we actually have media elites suggesting that the key to saving democracy is having a one-party democracy, supported
yeah.
by the media, like being enforced by the media. And so I think you're right that that's where we're going, but I don't think we're going to lose the Democratic veneer, right? I don't think we're going to, I think we're still going to be doing this play. I think we're still going to have this show, even if it becomes more and more obvious. And I think you're right that there's a tacit acknowledgement of the failure of democracy by adopting, you know, people like Klaus Schwab or Bill Gates as kind of these unelected oligarchs who are ruling everything. But again, this is how Augustus took power, right? Octavian never named himself emperor of the Roman Empire. He just slowly absorbed the powers of other offices until eventually the Caesar became, you know, the ruler of Rome in every way. And so I think there's a little bit of that going on where these it's safer to maybe in many ways not be elected, right? To have elected officials funneling power to these people who don't have an official title. Bill Gates doesn't have an official title. He doesn't sit in a capital seat anywhere, but funneling power up to these people, taking the loose powers that existed in nations and under official titles and moving them under the domain of these technocratic oligarchs is a way to do that without necessarily directly saying democracy has failed and now we have to hand this over to a dictator, but, you know, still getting the job done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in Britain, I don't know how true this is of America. I'm sure it is. In Britain, we've always had the civil service, in Whitehall, which there's a famous sitcom from the 80s called Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister. And it's all about the relationship between elected, democratically elected politicians and the civil servants who aren't elected. They have full careers in a position and they'll be elected through, they'll be promoted through the system, get ever more seniority and ever more power, like actual real power. And I think this is part of it, that really it was them, it was the civil servants who had the real power. The democratically elected politicians were just there to give the electorate, to complete the lie for the electorate that they had the power, that the electorate had the power, and that these politicians were doing what they wanted. As I say, for various reasons, that facade seems to be getting... and I'm not saying it was totally a facade. I'm sure that politicians did and still do have some power. But I think that it is being supplanted now by this move to technocracy. So yeah, it's obviously a very complicated subject, and we've only scratched the surface here. But I'm going to have to end this one because this is the first night, and I only had 3 hours sleep last night because I was first of all I was busy doing all the last minute work for Millennial, and then I was just sort of on edge and I couldn't relax, so I'm getting very tired and I'm worried that if we go on I won't be able to keep up. But I think this has been a very good discussion, Oren, so I hope this has been of use to you and of interest to the viewers.
Yeah, man, absolutely. No, I appreciate you having me. It's been an honor.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad that you agreed to appear because I have seen your videos and I do like them. I mean, it's, as I said, it's kind of difficult being keeping track of everything now, but there is so much going on and there are so many channels emerging and taking root and growing. It's always, you know, the movement just constantly evolves. What we have, the movement, I'm not sure if that's the best phrase to use at this point, but the community of channels and content creators always evolves. So, okay, well, thank you, Oren McIntyre. This is the end of the first night of Millennial 2021. I will be back tomorrow night with Mark Gullick, Charles Roberts. Oh, no, hold on a second. Hold on. Sorry. Okay, UK Column, Survive the Jive, Mark Gullick, and then Charles Robertson. So that'll be the second night. In the meantime, thank you, Oren McIntyre. And I hope that this has been I hope you've enjoyed this opening night of Millennial 2021. I'm going to get some sleep now. So thank you, everyone, and I will see you later.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.